eyes and then beware, man, eyes and then beware, man. Cross the desert's fair, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. I'll travel, I've had my share, man, eyes and everywhere.
Budapest is the capital of what European country? Budapest is the capital of what European country Nathan has already locked in?
This might be a stupid question.
I'm guessing it's probably
okay.
Going to be.
Like, I thought Europe was a country. Let's see. Budapest? I never even heard of that.
All right, here's your options. I mean, you could drop out with $10,000.
Like, I know they speak French there, don't they? Like, I want to say, is France a country? I don't know what I'm doing.
You know what? Let's talk.
Like,
let's talk about your options.
Okay.
Kel.
Yes.
Focus.
I am. Like, I'm listening to what you're saying, but I only hear what I want to.
That's just called being a woman. If you had had to guess, do you have a guess?
I don't think France is a country, but I would have said that. I don't know. I'm just going to say France. I don't know.
Okay. France is a country. I will tell you that. If you had said France, you would have gone home with nothing. That's not the right answer. The right answer is Hungary.
Is what?
Hungary.
Hungary?
Like I'm hungry.
That's a country? I've heard of Turkey, but Hungary, never heard of it.
But the answer is Hungary.
Hey, pretty baby, are you ready for me? Yeah, you good rockin' daddy down from Tennessee. I'm just out off about San Antonio with a radio blasting and the bird dog on. Yeah, speed travel, my head's down the town, but no local yoga gonna shut me down. Me and my boys got the trigger around, and we'll come a thousand miles from a guitar jam.
If you're a country music fan, particularly classic country, join me, Cope Reynolds, every Friday night for Liberty Lounge right here on the Survival Circle Network.
Nothing ever happened around my hometown. I ain't kind of just hang around. But I heard someone call my name one day, and I followed that voice down a lost highway. Everybody told me you can't get far on $37 in a Jeep guitar. Smoking in a Texas with a hammer down and a rockin' little combo from the guitar down.
Absolutely the fastest 2 hours on internet radio, Liberty Lounge. Every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific, 10 to midnight Eastern. Right here on Survival Circle.
Love to hear the steel bell coming on the asphalt. Wake up in the middle of the night in a truck stop. Stumble in a restaurant. Wonder why I don't stop.
Welcome to the Shooting Bench. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you commentary and important updates on current events, as well as information on guns, training, preparedness, and other liberty-related issues. Let's get started. RAT, right now. Okay, looks like we made it in here. Welcome to the Shooting Bench. It is the 8th of November, and it's a Wednesday. And I just about threw in the towel. I was having a conversation with the tinker. I'd been fighting with it. He says, you're going to be on at the top of the hour? And I said, I don't know. It's not looking like it. And then all of a sudden, the internet started working. I just got a new modem here and everything, and I'm still having trouble. So I don't know what we're going to do. But it's on right now, so if we mysteriously disappear in the middle of the show, you'll know what happened. So don't call the authorities. We're okay. We just can't keep things running. So let's get on with a few things we need to talk about here. Tonight's the night I'm going to, I've got a few things we want to discuss, but tonight's the night I'm going to read that thing to you that I told you I was going to read the other day. It's an interesting little story. It's cheerful. It's neat. It's kind of uncharacteristic we don't usually do cheerful and neat, but it's a neat little story. So we'll get on with that here in a few minutes. I don't know if some of you seen what happened in or what is happening in California. We have a feller there named Bob Smith that runs a horseshoeing school. Bob Smith trains quite a number of horseshoers. There's good market for that in certain places. Like around here, there's a lot of horse people around here. And good horseshoers. Now, anybody can tack a shoe on a horse. That's not that big a deal. And, if you're out in the rocks or something, anything may be better than nothing. But it's pretty easy to cripple a horse when you put those shoes on wrong, or if the horse has problems with his feet, he needs corrective shoeing, and things have to be just right, then you can't just go out there and buy a horseshoe and bend it around a little bit and stick it on and call it good. Everything has to be the mated surface there between the hoof and the shoe has to be right. It has to be level. The horse has to be, you can think if you took a shoe, a boot, and pulled it on in one side of it, not front and rear, but if one side, let's say under the ball of your big toe along that side, was a half inch higher than the other side. And let's say you had the same thing going on the other foot. Or maybe it was along your little toe, that whole side of your boot was a half inch higher. Yes, the boots will protect your feet from stickers. Yes, you can cross the hot highway with your boots on. But how long is it going to be before you are going to be crippled or so fatigued and so exhausted and so sore from working? And this is the same thing that happens with horses' feet. The feet have to match the ground. If you're, an eighth of an inch, a quarter of an inch or whatever, off on one side or on the front, the feet are not hitting the ground normally like they're supposed to. And if the horse, again, has some problems that needs corrected, we have people with, somebody that's flat feet, club-footed, whatever the problem is with your feet, you have to have special attention to your shoes, to your footwear. So any old horseshoer won't do that. And there's a lot of bad ones out there that's crippled a lot of horses. But be that as it may, that wasn't the part of the story here. I just wanted to throw that in there to give you an idea of what the demand is for good horseshoers. Good horseshoers are not cheap. Well, Bob Smith trains horseshoers to be farriers, as they call them, to be good horseshoers. He has a very, very nice facility, a lot of money in it, and trains, 20, 30 horseshoers at a time. The state of California, you might know this was going to come out of California. Unbelievable. I got another story coming out of California in a minute, too. Not surprising. California legislators have threatened to shut down Bob Smith's horseshoeing school if he doesn't agree to stop admitting students without a high school diploma. Now let that sink in just for a minute. I didn't have a high school diploma most of my adult life. Until I went into the Army, I went to work at places and they hired me because I knew what I was doing. I was good at what I did. I was strong. I was good sized. So I was particularly well suited to construction and the oil rigs and drilling rigs and stuff like that. And they could care less whether I could spell, you know, as long as they figured if you can sign his name on the paycheck, well, that's really all that matters. And they wanted production. They wanted people that would work. It didn't matter if he was smart enough, as long as he was smart enough to do the job. So here's Bob Smith trying to to help these people that are getting out there ambitious. They want to work. Horseshoe is not easy money. I promise you that. You can get by with one or two horses, and you'll see pretty quick that it can get tough. And you get cantankerous horses, and you get big horses, and you get lazy horses that won't help hold their feet up, you know, a little bit. Hang on, Mountain Shooter. We'll get to that in a minute. You do 6, 8, 10 horses a day, and I'll tell you what, brother, you've had a day. So it ain't that these guys are lazy or anything. They're out there trying to get a job, trying to do what's right, and the state of California is threatening to shut them down. Now, he is trying to fight back. He's filing a federal lawsuit to shut down this state's unconstitutional teaching ban. And that falls under, let me find something here. I believe that the law that they say he's in violation of, now you can look this up. It's the California Private Post-Secondary Education Act of 2009. California Education Code Section 94800. And in that legislation, they're trying to keep honest businessmen and women from hiring people without a high school diploma. Why? Because it's California. I don't know why. It's just stupid. That's what they do there. So it's astonishing to me. But it is, Yakima Glock, stand by just a minute. I'll get you a link to that story. Mountain Shooter, I don't know that Jason ever had blueprints for True and Remington Action. I don't, if he ever did, it was not while he was working for me. That was, you know, he was good at what he did, but that was a little above his pay grade, getting into that stuff. So I don't know that he ever had one. Let me grab that. Let's see here. It's on Facebook. So let me see if I can pull that off there. And well, if you're not a Facebooker, you may not be able to find it here. Let's see. Let me go here and see if I can bring that up for you. If I can't get it, it probably wouldn't be too hard to do a search to find it. Here is, now if you'll stand by, I'll keep the volume down on this. I'll click on this and see if I can bring it up on this YouTube video. This may not work either. Well, just do a search for California denies blue collar workers entry to trade school. Or Bob Smith's horseshoeing school might do it. Shouldn't be too hard to find either way. I hope my internet holds up. It sure seems like it's slow. So, the other thing coming from Californistan is the NAACP there, unbelievably. You know, every time, and I put this on Facebook earlier, I said, every time that I think the apex of stupidity has been reached, the apex of the most ignorant, retarded, nonsensical, unheard of crap that you've ever imagined in your life. When I think they've finally reached that point that it can't go any farther, once again, California comes through. And the they're the NAACP out of the, I think it might have been San Francisco, but anyway, it's a California branch of the NAACP, wants to eliminate, change, stop, get rid of the Star Spangled Banner as our national anthem. Now, I don't know what you folks think about that, but I can tell you that they are trying desperately, in my mind, to start a war. I don't even know what to say. I don't know how you deal with something like that. But they're saying that the Star Spangled Banner, our national anthem, is the most racist, the most, slave friendly, what the heck? Let me see if I can find that. I got sidetracked here off of another deal. As you know, Amy's one daughter is absolutely petrified of snakes. And I found a neat little video to send to her. And it showed a fairly lengthy snake crawling into a backpack. And it went in there and it's going nice and slow. And the entire length of the snake got inside the backpack. So some clever video guy, the guy reached down to open the backpack. The backpack was laying on its back on the floor. So he's picking up the front where it was unzipped and lifted up a little ways. And you can see that big old snake. And then all of a sudden, all you see is a snake's mouth come out of there. Somebody has tweaked the video a little bit and it shows that snake up there. And it's a little unnerving. And for somebody that is so scared of snakes, I'm sure it didn't do her any good. But a little stimulation of the heart, I think, is good for you every once in a while. So let me find this, let me find the description of what they said about the Star Spangled Banner. It made me furious. Let's see here. Okay, here it is. Now, says it's one of the most racist, pro-slavery, anti-black songs in the American lexicon. This is the California NAACP, the Sacramento chapter of the NAACP. And they also want that idiot that started Kaepernick, they also want him to be put back on a team. The Star Spangled Banner is one of the most racist, pro-slavery, anti-black songs. How do they get that? Where do you get that? Where is there anything about now? If you go back to the original, I don't know about the original, but the explanation of the real is, it, if you look it up on YouTube, it's the Star Spangled Banner as you've never heard it before. Now in that story, well, even then it wasn't slaves; they were prisoners of war. There was a bunch of people in the bottom of the boat being forced to row and everything, but they wasn't slaves, they were prisoners of war. It's a little bit different thing. So I haven't got the foggiest notion of where they get this racist, anti-black. There's nothing mentioned. This was during the Revolutionary War. At that point, you know, if it was a Civil War song, well, maybe it would be a little different. But this was way back. I don't know. I am completely dumbfounded here, which doesn't take much sometimes, but Mountain Shooter, I know a guy here locally that could do that, but you've probably got, you know, 500 of them in California that can take care of that action for you. So. Anyway, there you have it. I'm not sure what to say about that. It irks me till I can't see straight. So let me get ready to read this deal to you. I'm not sure exactly how long it'll take. It's kind of a lengthy deal. Let me turn my sound off here. You don't need all that. There we go. It's kind of a lengthy thing, but I think you'll enjoy it. It's a little slow taking off, so bear with me a little bit. And I'll tell you what, I can look for this during a break. We're taking a break just a little bit early, so we'll just play a song here and we'll get back with it here. So give me just a second.
I'll be back.
Now, war is coming between light and darkness. Will you bow down to the darkness? Or will you fight?
Welcome to Doc's Freedom Files.
Freedom. Keep walking, keep on your toes, and don't stop.
Sweet Pea and I recently watched the Cold War movie classic Red Dawn again. The film still holds up well, decades after it was made, and there are still lessons to be learned from it. It was filmed in 1984, an era when people were more worried about winding up in Soviet concentration camps than our own FEMA versions. I don't think I'm going to give away any plot spoilers here, but if you're one of the two or three people who've never seen this movie, tune out now. The film's plot centers around a communist invasion of the United States by the then Soviet Union and their Cuban client state. A group of small-town high school students avoids capture by fleeing to the mountains and become anti-communist guerrilla fighters. They then proceed to wreak mayhem on the occupiers of their community. At the time of its production, the film was widely condemned by the left as over the top and depicting an implausible scenario. But if one makes allowances for a bit of Hollywood excess, the core of the film is essentially plausible. Insurrection is basically a young man's game, and throughout history, many insurrectionists, including those in our own American Revolution, were in their teens when they took up arms. It is also true that small guerrilla forces can vex much larger regular armies. This has been proven many times in recent history, with the U.S. experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Soviet experience in Afghanistan, the Vietnam War, and even the experience of the Axis armies fighting Eastern European communist guerrillas in World War II. At one point in the movie, the mayor's son, a childhood friend of most of the group, proves to be a traitor. He is discovered to have smuggled a tracking device into camp, allowing Soviet troops to discover their location and then mount an attack. The Patriot guerrillas successfully defend against the attack and capture one of the Soviet soldiers. In the next scene, the Patriots execute their traitorous comrade and the captured Soviet soldier. The camera then shows the guerrillas mounting their horses and slowly riding away, with the bodies of the Soviet soldier and their traitorous erstwhile friend lying in the foreground. It is one of the film's more somber moments. "I don't think I could do that," I said to Sweet Pea as the scene ended. "Why not?" she asked, with more than a hint of surprise. "Honey," I replied, "I could never ride a horse worth a damn." This is Doc Toops wishing you life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Welcome back to another segment of the Shooting Bench, right here on the Survival Circle Radio Network.
That ain't country. I think we're back. Yakima Glock, you're right. Thanks for the correction. It was the War of 1812, not the Revolution. Thank you for pointing that out there. So let me check the chat room, see if there's anything else in here, see if I made any other mistakes. Okay. All right, let me read this to you. This is apparently, I looked it up, and it is apparently a true story. And by the way, coming up, got Veterans Day coming up this weekend. I hope everyone is continuing to boycott the NFL. There's a lot of stuff online about that. Matter of fact, there was a guy with a license plate that said XNFL something. Anyway, let me bring this up here again. Okay, this is apparently a true story. It has to do with baseball. Amy might like this. In Nashville, Tennessee, during the first week of January 1996, more than 4,000 baseball coaches descended upon the Opryland Hotel for the 52nd annual ABCA convention. 19 times since, many of the same professional college, high school, youth, and a slew of international coaches from passionate and developing baseball nations have gathered at various convention hotels across the country for 2.5 days of clinic presentations and industry exhibits. Sure, many members of the American Baseball Coaches Association have come and gone in those years. The leadership has been passed from Dave Kilitz to his son Craig, and the association and baseball in general has lost some of its great coaches, including Rod Dedeau, I guess that's how you pronounce that, Gordy Gillespie, and Chuck Brayton. I've attended all but 3 conventions in those 19 years, and I have enjoyed and benefited from each of them, but 1996 was special. Not just because it was held in the home of country music, a town I'd always wanted to visit, and not because I was attending my very first convention. Nashville in 96 was special because it was there and then that I learned that baseball, the thing that brought 4,000 of us together, was merely a metaphor for my own life and those of the players I hoped to impact. While I waited in line to register with the hotel staff, I heard other more veteran coaches rumbling about the lineup of speakers scheduled to present during the weekend. One name in particular kept resurfacing, always the same sentiment. John Skolinos is here? Oh man, worth every penny of my airfare. Who in the hell is John Skolinos, I wondered. No wonder, I was just happy to be there. Having sensed the size of the group during check-in, I woke up early the next morning in order to ensure that I'd get a good seat near the stage. First chair on the right side of the center aisle, third row back, where I sat alone for an hour until the audiovisual techs arrived to fine-tune their equipment. The proverbial BB in a boxcar, I was surrounded by empty chairs in a room as large as a football field. Eventually, I was joined by other slightly less eager coaches until the room was filled to capacity. By the time Augie Garrido was introduced to deliver the traditional first presentation from the previous season's College World Series winner, there wasn't an empty chair in the room. ABCA conventions have certain party-like quality to them. They provide a wonderful opportunity to reconnect with old friends from a fraternal game that often spreads its coaches all over the country. As such, it is common for coaches to bail out of afternoon clinic sessions in favor of old friends in the bar. As a result, I discovered the crowd is comparatively sparse after lunch, and I had no trouble getting my seat back, even after grabbing a plastic wrap sandwich off the shelf at the Opryland gift shop. I woke early the next morning and once again found myself alone in the massive convention hall reviewing my notes from the day before, pitching mechanics, hitting philosophy, team practice drills, all technical and typical, important stuff for a young coach, and I was in heaven. At the end of the morning session, certain that I had accurately scouted the group dynamic and that my seat would again be waiting for me after lunch, I allowed myself a few extra minutes to sit down and enjoy an overpriced sandwich in one of the hotel restaurants. But when I returned to the convention hall 30 minutes later before the lunch break ended, not only was my seat not available, barely any seats were available. I managed to find one between two high school coaches, both proudly adorned in their respective team caps and jackets. Disappointed in myself for losing my seat up front, I wondered what had pried all these coaches from their bar stools. I found the clinic schedule in my bag. It said 1 p.m., John Scalinas, Cal Poly Pomona. It was the man whose name I had heard buzzing around the lobby 2 days earlier. Could he be the reason that all 4,000 coaches had returned early to the convention hall? Wow, I thought, this guy must be really good. I had no idea. In 1996, Coach Scalinas was 78 years old and 5 years retired from a college coaching career that began in 1948. He shuffled to the stage in an impressive standing ovation, wearing dark polyester pants and a light blue shirt, and a string around his neck from which a home plate hung, a full-size, stark white home plate. Seriously, I wondered, who in the hell is this guy? After speaking for 25 minutes, not once mentioning the prop hanging around his neck, Coach Scalinas appeared to notice the snickering among some of the coaches. Even those who knew Coach Scalinas had to wonder exactly where he was going with this, or if he had simply forgotten about home plate since he's gotten on stage. Then, finally, you're probably all wondering why I'm wearing home plate around my neck. Or maybe you think I escaped from Camarillo State Hospital, he said. I laughed along with the others, acknowledging the possibility. No, he continued, I may be old, but I'm not crazy. The reason I stand before you today is to share with you baseball people what I've learned in my life, what I've learned about home plate in my 78 years. Several hands went up when Scalinas asked how many Little League coaches there were in the room. He said, do you know how wide home plate is in Little League? After a pause, someone offered 17 inches, more of a question than an answer. That's right. How about in Babe Ruth? Any Babe Ruth coaches in the house? Another long pause. 17 inches, came a guess from another reluctant coach. That's right. Now, how many high school coaches do we have in the room? Hundreds of hands shot up as the pattern began to appear. How wide is home plate in high school baseball? 17 inches, they said, sounding a little more confident than the rest. You're right. And you college coaches, how wide is your home plate in college? 17 inches, they all said in unison. Any minor league coaches here? How wide is home plate in pro ball? 17 inches. Right. And in the major leagues, how wide is home plate in the major leagues? 17 inches. 17 inches, he confirmed, his voice bellowing off the walls. And what do they do with a big league pitcher who can't throw the ball over 17 inches? There was a pause, and he said, send them to Pocatello, he hollered, drawing a raucous laughter. What they don't do is this. They don't say, oh, that's okay, Jimmy. You can hit, you can't hit a 17-inch target. We'll make it 18 or 19 inches next year. We'll make it 20 inches so you have a better chance of hitting it. If you can't hit that, let us know. We'll make it wider still. May I say 25 inches? There was a pause. Coaches? Another pause. What do we do when our best player shows up late to practice? When our team rules forbid facial hair and a guy shows up unshaven? What if he gets caught drinking? Do we hold him accountable or do we just change the rules to fit him? Do we widen home plate? The chuckles gradually faded as 4,000 coaches grew quiet, the fog lifting as the old coach's message began to unfold. He turned the plate towards himself and using a Sharpie, began to draw something. When he turned it toward the crowd, point up, a house was revealed, complete with a freshly drawn door and two windows. "This is the problem in our homes today," he said. "With our marriages, with the way we parent our kids, with our discipline, we don't teach accountability to our kids. And there's no consequence for failing to meet standards. We widen the plate." Another pause. Then to the point at the top of the house, he added a small American flag. "This is the problem in our schools today. The quality of our education is going downhill fast, and teachers have been stripped of the tools they need to be successful and to educate and discipline our young people. We are allowing others to widen home plate. Where is that getting us?" There was silence. He replaced the flag with a cross. "And this is the problem in the church, where powerful people in positions of authority have taken advantage of young children, only to have such an atrocity swept under the rug for years. Our church leaders are widening home plate." I was amazed. At a baseball convention where I expected to learn something about curve balls and bunting and how to run better practices, I had learned something far more valuable. From an old man with home plate hung around his neck, I learned something about life, about myself, about my own weaknesses, and about my responsibilities as a leader. I had to hold myself and others accountable to that which I knew to be right, lest our families, our faith, our society continue down an undesirable path. "I am so lucky," Coach Scalinos concluded. "You will remember one thing from this old coach today. It is this. If we fail to hold ourselves to a higher standard, a standard of what we know to be right, if we fail to hold our spouses and our children to the same standards, if we are unwilling or unable to provide a consequence when they do not meet the standard, and if our schools and churches and our government fail to hold themselves accountable to those they serve, there is but one thing to look forward to." With that, he held home plate in front of his chest, turned it around, and revealed its dark black backside. And he said, "Dark days ahead." Coach Scalinos died in 2009 at the age of 91, but not before touching the lives of hundreds of players and coaches, including mine. Meeting him at my first ABCA convention kept me returning year after year, looking for similar wisdom and inspiration from other coaches. He is the best clinic speaker the ABCA has ever known because he was so much more than a baseball coach. His message was clear. Coaches, keep your players, no matter how good they are, your own children, and most of all, keep yourself at 17 inches. He was indeed worth the airfare. So, that's it. Ordinarily, I don't take a lot of time for stories like that, but I started this and the deeper I got into it, the more intrigued I got, and I was exceedingly glad that I finished this story. It was really neat. I hope y'all enjoyed that. So, let's see. There is and I don't have anything else to say about baseball or sports or anything else about that. I'll say that Coach Scalinos is dead on the money. And that is you talk to cooks, construction workers, oil field hands, teachers, horseshoers, whatever. You find some analogy that has to do with that they can relate to in what they do, and it sticks with them. And these baseball players will forevermore remember the 17-inch plate or widening the plate, accountability, and all that comes along with it. If y'all want to look that up, it is, you might want to share it with others. It's called Stay at 17 Inches. It's in quite a number of places. You can look it up. Let me tell you this right here, if you want to look it up. www.sperrybaseballlife. Sperry is S-P-E-R-R-Y. sperrybaseballlife.com /stay-at-17-inches. So, there you have it. So I'm going to hit a few facts here about Arizona that I found. I know we're getting kind of off of our normal deal here, but I've been holding these for a long, long time, looking for a good time to slip them in here, so this is one of those times. And I'm not going to finish this because there are lots and lots of them, but we're going to go through a few and talk about them here. Arizona, as many of you have heard us talk, you know, and back when we were in Luna, because we're only 14 miles from Arizona while we were there. And people think Arizona and most of New Mexico is all desert. When you mention Arizona, saguaro cactus is all they see. And, you know, they don't realize what we have. Yeah, the most of the southern, less than half, southern third of the state is very much desert. 124 to 125 degrees, fairly frequent, you know, 115. The cactus, the sand, the lack of water, the whole nine yards. I mean, it's very desert. But as you start coming to the north, you start getting into an entirely different world from what you just left. And many people that have not visited northern Arizona have no clue what it's like up here. So with that in mind, listen to this first fact in Arizona. And this one even floored me. Arizona has 3,928 mountain peaks and summits, more mountains than any one of the other mountain states, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, or Wyoming. I know that Wyoming has the longest single chain of mountain peaks in excess of 12,000 feet, but not 3,928 of them. When I brought people out here to visit from back east, I brought several different people out from Georgia and from Pennsylvania and whatnot, and they cannot fathom the size of the states out here. I took some of the people from Georgia up to Wyoming, and they can't really figure, they don't see how big these states are. I guess they don't look at the map and really put it all together in their head, you know, that doesn't really hit home until you start driving across these states. All of New England, including the state of Pennsylvania, will fit inside of Arizona. Now, Arizona is not nearly the biggest state by any means. It's just that these facts are about Arizona, so that's why it's there. Arizona became the 48th state and the last of the contiguous states on Valentine's Day, April 14th, 1912. There's another little story about the Valentine's Day. We'll get into that later. Arizona's disparate climate can yield both the highest temperature across the nation and the lowest temperature across the nation in the same day. You remember back in New Year's of 2011, it was like 30 below here. It's not hard, as I said a while ago, to find in excess of 120 degrees, 125, 126 degrees in several places. You know, Quartzsite in over around Lake Havasu and over in there. Phoenix, typically 115, 116 degrees in summer, not unusual at all. There are more wilderness areas in the state of Arizona than in the entire Midwest. Arizona alone has 90 wilderness areas, while the Midwest has 50. Arizona has 26 peaks that are more than 10,000 feet in elevation. If you've ever driven down I-40, you can see a lot of those in the distance, but you drive right by one as you go through Flagstaff. And if you look off to the north of Flagstaff, there is a huge mountain there, 12,000 some odd feet, I think. And one of those 10,000-foot peaks is right out here. You step out on my balcony and look over here to the southeast from us, and you'll see one of those 10,000-foot peaks about 10, 12 miles from here or something like that. This is another good one here. This really blows the desert thing out of the water. You know, I'm going to look and see if we're speaking here to empty chairs. Oh, it looks like everything's still working, hopefully. All right. Arizona has the largest contiguous stand of ponderosa pines in the world, stretching from close to Flagstaff along the Mogollon Rim to the White Mountain region, which is where I'm at right now. So by as the crow flies, that's probably, what is it, 150-some miles by highway. So, and there's only one turn to go. You go straight north to hit I-40 and turn left and go to Flagstaff. So probably 110, 125 miles, something like that. It may be closer to 150 because that stand of pines runs beyond beyond Flagstaff. So it may be close to 150 miles. Yuma, Arizona is the highest producer of winter vegetables, especially lettuce. Arizona is the sixth largest state in the nation, covering 113,909 square miles. All four of the four corner states, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah, pretty close to the same size. They're very, very similar. I think, I'm not positive, but I think Utah may be the smallest of the four, but not by much. It's a pretty good sized state there. Out of all the states in the U.S., Arizona has the largest percentage of its land designated as Indian lands, as reservations. If you look on the map, almost a quarter, certainly a fifth, 20%, I'm sure, of Arizona is strictly Navajo reservation. That's not counting the White Mountain Apaches and the Hopis and quite a number of other tribes around here. But if you look on the map, the entire northeast corner, all the way down to right at I-40, all the way over to Flagstaff and north, Highway 89, that entire corner is Navajo Indian Reservation. And it also stretches into New Mexico. The Navajo Indians have the largest Indian reservation, if I'm not mistaken, in the world. And a whole bunch of it is in Arizona. The five C's of Arizona's economy are cattle, copper, citrus, cotton, and climate. There are still a number of active copper mines down south of here, closer to, I won't say closer to Phoenix, but anyway, they're in southern Arizona. More copper is mined in Arizona than all other states combined. Now that's the Morenci mine is the largest copper producer in all of North America. Now if you look at some of the copper that they're pulling out of, or they were, I don't know what this current status of it is, up around Butte, Montana, there were some big copper mines up there back in the day. I don't know if they're still active or not. Clark Gable and Carol Lombard, two of the most prominent movie stars of Hollywood's golden age, were married on March 18, 1939 in Kingman, Arizona. Covering 18,608 square miles, Coconina County is the second largest county by land area in the 48 contiguous United States. 18,000. Coconino County is bigger than some of the states back east. Bisbee, Arizona, known as the Queen of the Copper Mines, because during its mining heyday, it produced nearly 25% of the copper for the entire world and was the largest city in the Southwest between St. Louis and San Francisco. That's saying something. Bisbee today is not much, but evidently it was. Billy the Kid killed his first man, Wendy Cahill, in Bonita, Arizona. And we may have someone. Let me check the chat room here. No. I know someone that is was related to Cahill's by marriage. I don't know if that's the same batch or not. Let's see here. Arizona grows enough cotton each year. Now, that's something, people. You think of cotton pickers. You think of, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, quite a bit of cotton in Texas. You don't think of that in Arizona too much, but down south, there's lots of cotton. Grows enough cotton each year here in Arizona to make more than one pair of jeans for every person in the United States. I'd say that's a substantial amount of cotton. Famous labor leader and activist, you've heard of Cesar Chavez, born in Yuma, Arizona. 1912, President William Howard Taft was ready to make Arizona a state. Now, here's the thing about Valentine's Day. In 1912, President Taft was ready to make Arizona a state on February 12th, but it was Lincoln's birthday. The next day, the 13th, was considered bad luck, so they waited until the following day, and that's how Arizona got to be the Valentine State. It became a state on February 14th. When England's famous London Bridge was replaced in the 1960s, the original was purchased, dismantled, and shipped stone by stone and reconstructed in Lake Havasu City, Arizona, where it still stands today. Mount Lemmon. Mount Lemmon, especially for you ham operators, there's a repeater on Mount Lemmon that reaches a tremendous amount of real estate down there. We can reach Mount Lemmon from here through Greens Peak, and if you can reach Mount Lemmon, I'll tell you what, you can cover a lot of country in southern Arizona, actually even well into New Mexico off of that. But Mount Lemmon is in the Santa Catalina Mountains, and is the southernmost ski resort in the United States. And that's funny, because Mount Lemmon is right on the outskirts of Tucson. And you wouldn't think that Tucson would be that close to a ski resort, but evidently they get plenty of snow there. Rooster Cogburn, Ostrich Ranch in Picacho, Arizona, is the largest privately owned ostrich ranch in the world outside of South Africa. All of this you can find in Arizona. We talked about saguaro cactus a while ago. If you're caught damaging one of those, much less cutting one down, but if you're caught just damaging one in any manner, you could spend more than a year in prison in Arizona. Yeah, they are slow growing now. The world's largest to scale collection of miniature airplane models is housed at the library of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona. Prescott's a neat town. If you're a gun person, go to Prescott. I think there are more gunsmiths in Prescott, Arizona than any place in the world. Of course, there's a gunsmith school there. But there are gun stores every third building on both sides of the street from one end to the other is a gun shop. Couldn't believe it. Never seen anything like it. So obviously prices ought to be pretty good because there is a lot of competition down there. Ruger is down there. There's a couple other gun companies right there close to Ruger's place too. Davidson's is down there, for those of you that have looked in at gun distributors and online wholesalers and whatnot. Davidson's is a huge one. This is another record we have here in Arizona, located on Arizona's western border, Parker Dam, the deepest dam in the world at 320 feet. South Mountain Park Preserve. Okay. South Mountain Park Preserve in Phoenix is the largest municipal park in the country. See, we got a lot of things to, got a lot of bragging rights here in Arizona. Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station, located about 55 miles west of Phoenix, generates more electricity than any other U.S. power plant. The people up here on the mountain, what we say, what we would call up on the mountain, this is the White Mountain area, which is to the outskirts would be Snowflake, but mostly Springerville, Sholo, Vernon, Pine Top, Lakeside, Heber, Overgard, Forest Lakes, all this, what they call, you know, what people down in the valley call up on the mountain. We call down the valley down in Phoenix. And a lot of people up here would be concerned if something were to happen to that nuclear power plant, would we get a lot of fallout here? And that's one of the things, it's a very valid concern and a very popular concern for people that live up here or that travel up here, is will that happen? And it's virtually impossible or very, very unlikely that we would receive even a little bit of that because of the cross between the elevation and the prevailing winds here. That's all going to be carried well south of us, and I think I have zero concern for fallout from Palo Verde coming up here. Oribe, a Hopi village located in Navajo County, Arizona. Navajo County is the next county over from us. We're in Apache County. Dates back to before AD 1200 and is reputed to be the oldest continuously inhabited community in America. So that's just a few of the things. We've got lots of cotton picking things to brag about here in Arizona. So there's a lot more of them, and we'll probably may touch on a few of them Friday and maybe do some more next week. But I don't know if you're as interested in that as I was, but I thought it was kind of neat. Anyhow, we're going to scoot on out of here, and we will, all things working properly, then we should be back for Liberty Lounge on Friday. Right now, the internet has held up good for this part of it, and we've got some gun stuff I want to throw in Friday, too. Not much. I don't want to disturb our Liberty Lounge, but just a couple of things. Okay, thanks for joining me, and I will see you again Friday evening. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Shooting Bench. Join me Monday and Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific, and again on Fridays from 7 to 10 for the Shooting Bench. Good night, and thanks for joining me. No reconciliation.